loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we talk about all things regarding the so-called Russiagate scandal. There have been major big issues that have been reported by the media in the last several days. The jury is still out in the Paul Manafort trial. That will, of course, have profound implications for the Mueller probe. Donald Trump says the Mueller probe is about influencing the midterm 2018 elections. We're going to talk about all of that. And then, because it's Monday, we're going to talk about technology. Our weekly half-hour segment called Technology Rules with Chris Garofa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations in the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, the State Department has created something called the Iran Action Group to coordinate U.S. foreign policy toward that country. Detractors, however, say that the group's purpose is to create a policy to overthrow the Iranian government, and the group's membership is apparently classified. Next, nearly 90 South Korean families crossed into North Korea yesterday to be reunited with elderly relatives they had not seen since being separated in the chaos of the Korean War nearly 70 years ago. The reunification program has been ongoing for decades. It was suspended, and then it was restarted in the recent rapprochement between the two Koreas. Then, after eight grueling years of austerity, Greece today emerged from its bailout program. The $330 billion in loans from the European Union, the European Central Bank, and the International Monetary Fund saved the country from insolvency, but economic misery is still the norm, with unemployment remaining well over 20%. Today, we continue our segment, Education for Liberation, where we look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? And finally, we have a second Monday episode of Education for Liberation. And in other headlines, several shots were fired out of a vehicle into the U.S. Embassy compound in Ankara, Turkey this morning. Three bullets hit a guard post, but there were no injuries. This development adds to tensions between the United States and Turkey, countries that have historically been allies but whose friendship and relationship have frayed over a number of economic and geopolitical issues. A string of attacks on security forces has caused chaos across the Russian region of Chechnya today. Details are still emerging, but the attacks have been claimed by ISIS. According to Russian officials, the attackers were mostly teenagers under the age of 18. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau officially begins his re-election campaign today following the announcement of his decision yesterday. Trudeau will lead the Liberal Party into next year's general election, where it will compete with the Conservative Party and the New Democratic Party. Trudeau has been Prime Minister since 2015. A spokesperson for China's foreign ministry today condemned the visit by Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen to a NASA complex in Texas yesterday. Tsai was on a stopover in the United States during a tour aimed at shoring up support among Taiwan's dwindling number of allies in Latin America. The defeated forces of Chiang Kai-shek seized control of Taiwan following the end of the country's civil war in 1949, and Beijing has demanded the return of the island under its sovereignty ever since. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to some of the really big developments, and there are many, inside the so-called Russiagate. That's just now a banner or a brand. President Trump over the weekend revoked the security clearance of former CIA Director John Brennan and threatened to do the same to a list of other former Obama-era national security officials and current Justice Department officials. Meanwhile, media outlets reported that White House counsel Don McGahn met at least three times with special counsel Robert Mueller over 30 hours of meetings. This was Donald Trump's lawyer. President Trump tweeted early this morning that McGahn is, quote, not a rat, like in the Nixon White House, close quote. We're joined from New York by Jim Cavanaugh, the editor of thepolemicist.net, whose most recent piece is Fighting Fake Stories, The New Yorker, Israel, and Obama. And we're joined from New York by Ted Rawl. Ted is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist Jim and Ted, welcome back.
Thank you.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Well, we're recording this segment on Monday, and at this moment, we don't know yet. We might later. What might happen with the verdict? The jury's still out with the Paul Manafort trial. But there's been so many different and important developments. I'm looking at the Washington Post. I was reading the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, Politico, kind of screaming headlines. And you would think, at least from these headlines, that we're reaching the edge of the abyss, or at least the point of climax for the Mueller probe and the showdown with the Trump administration. Ted Rall, what's your take?
Yeah, we've been here before, and I think we're going to be here again. We constantly have, I mean, people are forgetting that the Paul Manafort case has really nothing to do at all with Russiagate as it's been teed up to us through the media. And what we're looking at, what this is really about, is about the allegations that Manafort was guilty of tax evasion and money laundering, a whole host of financial fraud, fraudulent financial schemes related to self-enrichment. And we'll hear how that's going to go. And there's a lot of speculation that he may be found guilty and then pardoned by President Trump. But we're not anywhere close to arriving at that point where we say there's not an aha moment here.
Jim Kavanaugh, what about McGahn, the President Trump's lawyer, meeting with Mueller for all of these interviews, 30 hours of interviews? There was an article on August 19th from Politico. The headline is, McGahn seen as, quote, undercover operative, close quote, in Trump's White House. Lawyers say that it's not likely that McGahn coughed up independently damning information, but could still help bolster Mueller's probe. Again, very speculative, but what's your take there?
Well, it seems like the Trump's first legal team, with the aptly mentioned named Ty Cobb and friend, were kind of just the incompetence of all of these people just amazes me. I mean, that they would let McGahn go into these meetings, first of all, let him go without contesting it. Secondly, that they would let him go and say, we're not asserting any privilege, which meant that he had to answer every question fully and honestly, and he couldn't say, you know, I'm protecting the executive privilege. Trump didn't seem to realize that McGahn is not his lawyer, but represents the office of the White House. Everybody here seems to be so incompetent, and it's like a clown car of lawyers. You know, now you got Giuliani jumping out, so I don't know what's going to come of it. Again, I think Ted is fundamentally right. Mueller has pretty much said he's not going to indict Trump, but what McCann is going to, the danger here is McCann provides a lot of details of conversations that someone could reasonably or unreasonably, perhaps reasonably, interpret as obstructing justice, because Trump will have said, I'm sure, I'd like this thing to be over with. Can't we do something about it, et cetera? So that's going to be a report to the Congress, which is going to be damning in some way. It's going to be a nasty report about it. It's going to look like Trump tried to obstruct justice. That's going to initiate another series of months or weeks of fighting, political fighting in the Congress about this. It's just such a waste of time. I mean, it demonstrates Trump's incompetence from the beginning. He should never have fired Flynn. He should never have appointed a special counsel. I didn't really see any reason to. And he didn't realize what he was getting himself into. And now it's going to go on for forever. And in the meantime, the country is falling apart. The country is in danger. It's in danger of wars. It's in danger of going to war with Iran. It's, you know, they're pulling back on the agreements with North Korea, which is no surprise to me. And these are the things that nobody's talking about. You know, immigrants are being torn from their children, and you've got inequality growing at an enormous rate, and nothing's being done about it.
Yeah, those are really important points. Ted, Trump is accusing Mueller's team of midterm meddling, trying to influence the midterm elections. As we have talked about and will continue to talk about on this show, we have John Bolton saying that Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran are all meddling and attempting to interfere in the 2018 congressional elections. Trump is accusing the Mueller team of midterm meddling. His tweets are getting more and more pronounced. Disgraced and discredited Bob Mueller and his whole group of angry Democrat thugs spent over 30 hours with the White House counsel, only with my approval for purposes of transparency. Anybody needing that much time when they know there is no Russian collusion is just looking for trouble. They enjoy ruining people's lives, etc. Anyway, what do you think about Trump accusing Mueller of meddling in the midterm elections?
You know, we have two sides. You know, it's possible to have two sides in opposition of an issue and not care for or believe either one. And this is one of those cases. I think the idea that that Mueller would be trying to interfere with the election is, of course, absurd on its face. And generally, if John Bolton tells me the time of day, I'm going to check my watch.
Wait a second. Does that mean that you don't think North Korea is actually trying to meddle in the 2018 midterm elections?
Well, this is one of those questions where one would have to ask, how would they do it? I know there North Korea stands accused without any substantial evidence of the Sony Pictures hack. And that is definitely something that's, but I think this reminds me a lot of the buildup to the war against Iraq with the so-called Axis of Evil, which supposedly involved North Korea as well as obviously as well as Iraq, and so you have these parties, these countries that don't really have much to do with each other, not much relationship whatsoever, except that just the U.S. has put them on the naughty list, and I guess they're going to get a piece of coal in their stockings this Christmas. But otherwise, there's kind of just no there. It's absurd. These people just say things without any kind, that are really kind of irresponsible, without any kind of supporting evidence. And what's crazy to me is that the media reports it so dutifully.
Yeah, I actually wrote a piece on that Sony hack business back when it happened, and when you looked at all that was going on with the hackers, they were using R.L. Stein, what's the guy, the children's books, as a kind of motif. And it was like Sony, the North Koreans were involved in this crazy hack with using this. Ted is absolutely right. People now are just making charges. And not only are they making charges, but once they're made and repeated three or four times in the right places by the right people, then they just become established facts that everybody, this is the crazy thing about this. You know, I mean, the United States put new sanctions on Russia over the Skripal poisoning, which even the British now have backed off from. You know, they can't claim, they don't even claim anymore that they know that the Russians did that. Yet it becomes a reason, an established fact, that the Russians did it, and therefore we have to put these crazy sanctions on, which are economic war. And these are very dangerous things. You know, all of this sanctions warfare, which is going to get very serious, you know, with Iran and Russia, and they are treating this as economic war, and it is. And people like Bolton, who, you know, do want to go to war against all of those countries he mentioned and want to, you know, eliminate diplomacy and just use aggressive tactics of all kinds, are really ratcheting things up in a very dangerous way that people don't realize the danger of this. And they just take for granted that these things can be done, that you can just state assertions and accusations, and then if the right people state them enough and the right, you know, influential, reliable media sources restate them enough, then they are becoming a fact, then they become established facts, and then we can use them as pretext for some kind of aggressive action, whether it's economic or military.
Ted Rall, the national security strategy that was released, and it is released every once in a while, I can't remember the frequency, but the last one was noteworthy in that it identified not Al-Qaeda, not ISIS, not so-called Islamic terrorism, or the war on terror as the priority for the Pentagon in the coming years for both budgeting and preparations, contingency planning. It identified major power conflict as the priority for the Pentagon. Now, that only can mean Russia and China because they're the major powers. Here we have the Russia gate creating, as Jim is saying, he considers it dangerous, creating an atmosphere of hostility and animus, maybe as preparing the public for some sort of conflict, major power conflict. And it was noteworthy to me over the last week that the Pentagon has now announced that China, People's Republic of China, is carrying out military contingency plans to bomb U.S. targets. And I thought to myself, okay, this is it. The Russiagate is morphing into a new phase, targeting China, the other part of the major power conflict axis that the Pentagon identified in the national security strategy. Okay, that seems like insanity to be preparing for war with China and Russia. Nonetheless, that's the road we are going down from a point of view of actual military preparedness and strategy and doctrine. Do you see what's going on as part of that? In other words, whatever the genesis of this was, that it's playing into this bigger, what I consider to be completely crazy Pentagon orientation?
Well, that's what we have to emphasize. It is crazy. You can ask Hitler how well it goes when you open two fronts with major powers. These wars don't work out well. The thing that is, aside from the fact that it's nuts and it's not a road we should go down, especially since there's absolutely no justification for it at this point. There's no reason to believe that China or Russia is going to attack the United States in any way, shape, or form. There's also the fact that this is a scenario that reflects, I think, a pivot away from the post 9/11 war on terror, where the system, the military-industrial complex, in an attempt to justify its sucking trillions of dollars out of the United States economy and out of the pockets of the taxpayers, in order to justify its existence, has found that the Al-Qaeda radical Islamist threat has obviously not proven to be potent enough in the minds of American voters to justify their existence. I mean, we're talking about the number of Americans who fall victim to Islamist terrorism every year is fewer than the number of people who get crushed by falling Coke machines. So they're going to have, now they're pivoting back to sort of Cold War plus. So it's not just Russia, but it's Russia plus China. And they're trying to hearken back to something that busy Americans can't. They can kind of grasp it because it's been in the air. It's kind of like Iran. It's been around as an enemy state for a long time. Most people don't really know all the details. And they're kind of counting on that people won't pay much attention to the details. Because ultimately, these people are no different than the police department in my little town where I live in eastern Long Island, where they're bloated with way too many cops for the size of the town, and there's no crime. So they have to justify their existence somehow.
The Washington Post articles, again, screaming headlines, Jim. We're now entering the most dangerous, the most intense and dangerous period of the Trump presidency is about to begin. And this is an opinion piece. Nonetheless, the Washington Post is glad to cover it and highlight it. Let's begin with a report in the New York Times that the case against Michael Cohen, Trump's former personal lawyer, might be coming to a head. Federal authorities investigating whether President Trump's former personal lawyer and fixer Michael Cohen committed bank and tax fraud have zeroed in on well over $20 million in loans obtained by taxi businesses that he and his family owned, according to people familiar with the matter. Investigators are also examining whether Mr. Cohen violated campaign finance or other laws by helping to arrange financial deals to help secure the silence of women who said they had affairs with Mr. Trump. The inquiry has entered the final stage, and prosecutors are considering filing charges by the end of August, two of the people said. And then the article goes on about the most intense and dangerous moment. There's a serious possibility that Cohen will cooperate with prosecutors in order to obtain leniency, and there's no telling what he might be able to reveal about the Trump Organization, the president himself, and the president's children with whom he worked closely. Jim, again, maybe true. Again, nothing about actual collusion with Russia, it seems to me. Of course, Michael Cohen has 200 medallions, taxi medallions. Not surprising that some of those loan applications for some of those overpriced medallions may have included untrue information. But again, how big of a deal is that for Trump, and how big of a deal is Michael Cohen?
I don't know in terms of his, again, business hijinks and financial fraud and tax evasion. You know, I would not be surprised at all, and I'd expect that he'd have information which would be damaging to Trump in that respect. But again, this has nothing to do with the supposed Russiagate or Russia collusion thing. Mueller doesn't seem to be interested in Cohen at all. And Cohen really has been trying to suggest that he might be helpful to Mueller and maybe use that against, it's really the Southern District of New York that's been prosecuting him, to try and get a deal from them. But maybe he doesn't have any information. I don't know. I have no idea. But, you know, again, I'd be very surprised if Donald Trump was not involved up to his ears in some kind of financial illegalities, you know, and it's just that's a danger to what, you know, that this is a danger to the Republic is, you know, the dangers to the Republic come from these other things that nobody's talking about, nobody's dealing with. Yeah, I mean, the danger to the Republic isn't from these financial frauds. I mean, they're nasty, and maybe Trump will be impeached for them or attacked for them, but the danger of the Republic comes from these other problems, the wars and the inequality and the economic situation of the people in this country and people dying from, you know, not having medical care and being bankrupted by not having medical care and being bankrupted by doctor bills and student loans. And nobody's doing anything about this. And this is the real danger that is destroying the country. And whether or not Donald Trump cheated on his taxes, that's not the danger to the Republic.
What, Ted Rald, how do you think this will play out? Obviously, the country is paying attention to politics. Trump's base is, I would say, really enthusiastic about Trump. I was just in Western New York over the past week. In the Finger Lakes region, Southern Tier, you have cities and towns like Geneva and Penn Yan and Bath, New York, with the exception perhaps of Ithaca, which is where Cornell is, maybe a little bit more liberal, pretty solidly Republican. What I picked up, even with conversations I had or overheard, is that people who are Trump supporters think this is a frame-up. These are the Washington elites, the politicians, the political establishment going after Trump. Trump is a non-politician politician. He's standing up for the Americans. If he were to be, that's some of the lingo you hear. If Trump were to be brought down under these circumstances, a big part of the population will feel that they themselves were screwed. In other words, that their favored candidate was undone by a legal process, which is really just a political process masquerading as a legal process. I mean, given the intensity of emotion in the country and the way this is being presented out, it doesn't seem to me to be politically palatable. Like, if I mean, Mueller and all of these guys, they're not just trying to get Trump. They're also the guardians of the existing political order to some extent. And, you know, they have to be aware of the consequences of their own actions. Is the political polarization something that will have a restraint on the process?
I think it will be, and it might be part of the reason Nancy Pelosi says that if the Democrats retake the House, they're not going to attempt impeachment proceedings pretty much no matter what. But I think what's going to push the Democrats into not pushing for impeachment is going to be more the proximity of 2020. If this had all gone down in 2017 with the Democratic Congress, it might have been a different calculus. But going into a presidential election where the primaries of campaign effectively begins in November of 2019, you're just not going to see Democrats taking over the House in late January and then trying to bang through an impeachment within a few months. It's not even possible. And they're just not going to want to, and they're not going to be able to unite their caucus. I think that there is the concern that that Republicans and Trump supporters who feel that this would be a deep state coup, I mean, they would be right. And the thing that's so difficult to tease out is the fact that much of Trump's support is indeed blind. These are people who would support Trump even if he were caught in, a treasonous, collusive relationship with Russia. But they would still believe him no matter what. But since There is no evidence of that heretofore, 2+ years into the investigation. And the hysteria and the media push, 24/7 on certain cable news channels. It really feels like it would be a deep state coup. And I think more sober Democrats have to know that this is something that could really tear the country apart politically, and the existing order could, I don't think people would take up arms. It's not like that, but I think it would cause a massive crisis in confidence, and it's impossible to predict where we would go from there.
Jim Kavanaugh, same to you. Go ahead.
As Ted said, there's a certain section of the Trump base which, no matter what he does, they'll be for him. But there's a whole other group, of much larger group, I think, of people who voted for Trump or didn't vote for anybody, but who buy the kind of, this right-wing populist line that we've been hearing since Joe Pine, guys who get on TV and say, I'm going to tell it like it is. And they think he's going to drain the swamp. Now, you could have spent the last 2.5 years demonstrating clearly that Trump is never going to drain the swamp, that he's an alligator, and that, look at what the effect of the tax cuts, look at what he's doing. He's not stopping wars. He came in to promise to stop the wars. It's not happening. More aggression against Russia. So, they could have made a political argument, spent time making a political argument. And if we come in, we will give you health care. We will end the student loan debt, et cetera. But they didn't do that. They spent 90% of their time on Russia, 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 Russia. And, as you say, at the end of the day, there's a lot of people who don't really care about that and don't really see the point of it. And if Trump gets impeached on that, but he's not going to be impeached. That's just been a waste of time. It's just constantly kind of damage him and discipline him and cage him and make it hard for him to do anything else that they don't want him to do.
Talk about wasting time, Ted Rall. We have 1 minute left. The big news story all over the weekend, I was driving back from Western New York, was Rudy Giuliani said the truth isn't truth on talk shows. And everybody's like, what? Wow. He said the truth isn't truth. And then he tried to explain himself by saying, well, one person's truth is somebody else's, somebody looks at it in a different way. Again, the discourse is so low, Ted Rall. This country is gone. Well, the country has gone into a political swamp if it ever emerged from one. I mean, it's just a disgusting level of discourse. 1 minute left. I wanted to end with you with this because you are a cartoonist and your job is to make fun of things.
Well, and my job has never been harder because the job of a cartoonist is to exaggerate and push things that are not extreme to their nth degree in order to point out the absurdity that is inherent in what seems normal. But these days, we don't have that. Things are already being pushed to their nth degree. So where can I go? We can't go faster than the speed of light, right, in the physics of satire. So that's kind of where we are now. And everything's zooming along. And all you can kind of do is just sort of shrug your shoulders and point at it, which does not make for really the best satire. It's not a golden age. It is disgusting, though. And, what's really lacking, I think, is intellectual honesty. I mean, I remember learning in elementary school or maybe high school that when you got involved in a debate, you always gave the other side its due. And you said, granted, these other guys are right about this and that. However, here's my counterargument. That's all gone. Now it's you don't give the other side any quarter whatsoever. And aside from it being unfair and not good debating, it actually makes you look stupid and it makes the whole thing look stupid.
Anyway, we've been joined from New York by Jim Kavanaugh, the editor of thepolemicist.net, where his most recent piece is Fighting Fake Stories, The New Yorker, Israel, and Obama. And we were joined once again from New York by Ted Rall. Ted is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. Stay with us. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's Monday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment, Technology Rules with Chris Garaffa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties. We're joined from New Haven, Connecticut, as we are every week by web developer and technologist Chris Garaffa. Chris, welcome back.
Hi, Brian and John, thanks. I hope everyone enjoyed the break last week.
We did. We had a week off. Many people wrote and said it was well-deserved, and I just liked every one of those comments that I received. But Chris Garaffa,
certainly agree with that.
Let's look at some of the big stories. Here's one about banks and retailers. Retailers are tracking how you type, swipe, and tap. Now, we know that we should be worried about the NSA, FBI, the National Surveillance State, but this is not the state. This is corporate America. This is Wall Street.
Right. This is Wall Street. This is retailers. This is all private corporations tracking. You know, we know, and we've talked about in the past, that they track what you purchase, what you look at and don't purchase, what you search for, all those things, and creates this sort of behavioral profile of you. But it goes even further, that some of these websites are even tracking how you type, the timing between you pressing one key and the next, or where your mouse goes on the screen, or you know what you hover over and what you click on, and even if you just select text on the screen, what it was. Now, they say they're using this to weed out, you know, these automated attacks on their services, and there is some truth to that for sure. You know, it can be used to identify, you know, massive, you know, robots attacking a website, but that doesn't stop there. They can also use this if it's not anonymized to identify individuals and to again create profiles. Were you hesitant when you were typing in a password? Maybe it's because you're not, it's a new account for you, or it's not an account that you actually should have access to. Were you hesitant to even, you know, click a link for a product? Maybe you were looking at another link or another product. And they're going to use all of these things, in fact, to profile us, and all of these things to create these digital identities with more information than we realize we're even giving away. You know, most people don't realize that how they type is, you know, unique to them generally, and or even how they swipe on their phone. All of those things actually can be tracked. It's relatively actually easy to do. Not just that, it goes even further. There are ways that you can get a web browser or a mobile application on your phone to tell you what angle you're holding your device at. You know, is it flat on your table? Is it being held up straight? Not just that, but how fast you're going, what direction you're going. And that's not even using, you know, GPS coordinates. It's just identifying speed. So there's all these things that we're not even aware that websites can, and apps as well, can get information on us about that we're just giving them because we don't even know that this is a thing.
I want to explore this a little bit more, John. I mean, it's okay. That's alarming. That's alarming. We're talking with Chris Garaffa. We talk with Chris every week at this time in a segment called Technology Rules with Chris Garaffa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedom, civil rights, and civil liberties. But this is not the national surveillance states. These are the places that we do online shopping with. And I want to read a couple of sentences here. It's from the New York Times. It's an article a week ago. When you're browsing a website and the mouse cursor disappears, it might be a computer glitch. Or it might be a deliberate test to find out who you are. The way you press, scroll, and type on a phone screen or keyboard can be as unique as your fingerprints or facial features. To fight fraud, a growing number of banks and merchants are tracking visitors' physical movements as they use websites and apps. And now Chris is saying, yeah, maybe partly that's the reason, but they're also building this profile. I have to tell you, John, if somebody was watching the way I scroll and type, it would be definitely unique because nobody goes this slow, has this much hesitation. I mean, it's, oh, that's Brian Becker, because it's almost like somebody who's illiterate who's doing the typing there.
But I'm not getting why they care. Who cares how we type? What? How can they monetize
that? I think it's because they want to know it's you, John,
it's you specifically,
or me, Brian, and then Right? I mean, that's what they're really, they want to know with specificity who it is that we are that's doing this typing. Is that correct?
That's correct. So there's two reasons that they want to gather this information. The first reason is exactly what you're saying, is they want to create essentially a digital fingerprint of you, right? So if you're typing in a password the same way on two sites, maybe they can identify that that's you. And then they can target you when you're logging in, even if you're on, you know, a new computer, a new web browser that you haven't used that doesn't have tracking cookies on it that most sites do set. They can still identify with some degree of certainty. This is Brian Becker because of the way he entered his password and moved the mouse around the corner and then clicked on text and selected text. The other reason is that they want to highlight what they're selling to you, right? So if you hover over a product on Amazon, but you don't actually click it, in theory, they could then go and say, well, Chris was interested in this, but didn't click it. But maybe we should push him a little bit and show him some more of these, or send him some emails saying, hey, you might be interested in these similar products. So it's two things. It's collecting data on us to create profiles for advertising and fingerprinting as well.
It's really something, the way the building, the profiling. I spoke last Thursday at a meeting of sponsored by a peace organization, anti-war organization in Geneva. The next day and the day later, I started getting in Facebook all of these, that little thing that says people you may know. And it was like all these people from Geneva, all these people from, some of whom were at the meeting, many of whom were not. But it was almost like I had called Mark Zuckerberg up and say, hey, I'm going to be speaking in Geneva. Can you give me some new potential Facebook friends? I mean, it's eerie.
That's how John and I are Facebook friends, actually.
Yeah, that's right.
You were in Geneva?
No. No. I didn't even think about Chris being on Facebook, and it recommended us to each other.
Anyway, not the national surveillance state. These are businesses. What else happens here? And is there any regulation? I mean, the companies are saying, look, they're trying to prevent fraud. They're trying to prevent bots. This is all good. But here's another quote. Identity is the ultimate digital currency, and it's being weaponized at an industrial scale. What does that mean?
That effectively, these companies do not want you to have anonymity or privacy, because if you're doing something trying to be anonymous or private, it effectively removes their ability to track you and create this data or advertising profile on you. It doesn't give them that opportunity to do it. And that's why they go further and further into using more and more obscure techniques in order to keep that, keep tracking us and using the information on us. And whoever would have thought that the way you move your mouse cursor on screen could uniquely or semi-uniquely identify you, and then combined with 200 other factors, like the angle that you regularly hold your phone at, it could lead to a profile of you that can be tracked between sessions, between devices even.
And so is this across the board? I mean, these companies, these retailers, these bankers, these online companies as well. I mean, are they actually compiling a digital fingerprint of, say, John Kiriakou or Brian Becker or Chris Garaffa? And then it's stored within the confines of their own commercial entity, or is this data shared amongst those who are doing business with each other, where we, in fact, are the commodity?
Right. So this is actually the really scary part about it. It's not just Amazon or your bank sitting there and collecting this information about you. It's actually, in most cases, a third-party provider. The ad network that they're using to put ads on their site, their analytics software, all of that is actually generally what these are, what's doing this tracking. So it's not just the site that you're on. It's a shared data collection service that they use to see, you know, who's coming to their website, what browsers they're using, all of these things. And then they're sending them to data brokers who share the information and then use that to identify who to send an advertisement to, what advertisement, and how much it's going to cost. And that all happens in instants, in milliseconds, as the website is loading on your screen. So no, it is not the surveillance state, but it's the corporate surveillance of people in order to do more advertising to just sell us more stuff. And on your question about regulation, There is no regulation. These companies just say, trust us, or trust our partners with your information. But there really is no corporate, there is no legal regulation that is worth even talking about on these matters. And we often see there's some sort of push after a major breach happens, right? We saw this with Facebook and Cambridge Analytica, but dozens of other companies have sprung up to take Cambridge Analytica's place afterwards, just as an example. And so the environment is rapidly changing, and the law, for many reasons, cannot or will not keep up with it.
Chris Garaffa is our guest. We talk about big technology issues every week in this segment called Technology Rules. Chris, let's go on to another story, but it's connected. There's a definite segue. We can connect the dots here. You talked about just now, you referred to that, yes, it's not the surveillance state, it's retailers, it's business interests. They're relying on third-party entities who collect the data and then sell it to them. But then there is the issue of the government itself. I'm looking at another story. It's been quite a big story the last couple of days. Exclusive, this is Reuters. U.S. government seeks Facebook help to wiretap Messenger. Let's talk about that story.
Yeah, this has been an extremely big story in the last few days since it broke. And of course, there's no official comment from either the Department of Justice or Facebook on this. So they are effectively asking Facebook to allow them to get copies of wiretaps of voice conversations that people are having, not over regular phone lines, but in Facebook's Messenger app. So you can actually have a conversation, a voice conversation, in the Messenger app. But that information still travels through Facebook servers. So what the Department of Justice is asking for is for Facebook to provide them with a way to decrypt that information. So when that information is sent from your phone to Facebook to somebody else's phone, it's encrypted, meaning that you have to have special keys for each device to understand what is in the message. And that's all taken care of automatically. But Facebook, because it owns the software, in theory would have the ability to actually go in and make changes to their device to create what's called a backdoor for the DOJ, the NSA, or whoever wants access to get access to the raw sound or text messages or whatever it is. And the article here from Reuters, this brings back, this issue back in, I believe it was 2016 with the San Bernardino shooting, where Apple was asked by the FBI to unlock somebody's iPhone, and they refused. And they said, we actually can't do this. We're not technically, able to. That disappeared sort of from public awareness because the FBI then contracted an Israeli company that was actually able to hack into that Apple device. So what this tells us is that, even if a company says that their device or their software is secure, there are always people, governments, private companies, looking for ways around that. And also, it tells us that we can't, necessarily trust any private company to not just give up our information as well. All of these companies in question here, Google, Facebook, Apple, Microsoft, LinkedIn, all of them, they all comply with NSA orders and other legal orders, and many of them are partners in the NSA's PRISM spying program. Now, if this were part of PRISM, we likely would not even have this story. But because it's an FBI request, we're talking about it, and the information has gotten out. I think on a political front, we have to talk about the context in which this is coming up. We know that Donald Trump has used the gang MS-13 as sort of the example of all immigrants in the United States. He has demonized immigrants, and every time he does, he brings up MS-13. And the Department of Justice is saying that this is related to an investigation against MS-13. And that really is only going to help poison the political landscape against immigrants and also against any company that actually tries to stand up against these orders from the Department of Justice.
But it's also... It does that. It has the impact of demonizing immigrant communities. But if you're going to force a company like Apple to break their own device, break it and give the FBI the right to listen to that phone and then all phones, or you're asking Facebook to break its own technology to de-encrypt Messenger, which it promotes to its consumers as an encrypted, as a secure thing. In order to do that, you have to create a compelling reason that the public would accept, or at least seemingly compelling reason. So MS-13, because there is a lot of gang violence and because there's a lot of killing, that seems like a perfect entity around which to begin this campaign. Like, similarly, the San Bernardino shooters, they were affiliated with ISIS, Islamic State. Well, nobody's for Islamic State. So are you going to take the side of the Islamic State terrorists, or are you going to take the side of the FBI when they want Apple to break their own machine? It's a perfect way in for intelligence, because they do actually have to have something that would move public opinion, which otherwise would say, wait, I don't want the FBI listening.
It's an infringement on my privacy.
Yeah, that's going to be the first reaction. So they have to manufacture a justification, a pretext, something that would sell with the public. So yeah, MS-13, a lot of people have been harmed by gang violence, especially in Latino communities. That seems like a good explanation. But here's my question is, will Facebook right now, just bring us up to speed with what's going on, will Facebook actually go through the process and fight back defiantly the way, say, a reporter and reporters have said, we're not going to reveal our sources, even if it's about a criminal act, even if somebody got killed, because the overall principle of protecting sources is more important? Do you think Facebook will have that same spirit?
I don't know. In this case, it may not be possible for them to get this specific information that they're being asked for because of the technical details behind the implementation of voice messages on Facebook Messenger. But I do think that they will be more than willing as a company to provide information and provide ways going forward for intelligence agencies and law enforcement to get this information when they request it, especially considering that Facebook is in this conflict at this point with both privacy activists and then, you know, some parts of the government that are trying to hold these hearings. So I think that ultimately they will provide some sort of way for the Justice Department to get further information. I don't think in this case they're actually going to be able to provide that, though.
And let's go back, because some people will know, but a lot of people won't know. You mentioned PRISM before. I mean, PRISM is a code name for a program under which the United States National Security Agency, NSA, collects internet communications from various U.S. internet companies. And John, this was a completely secret program. It was started in 2007. It carried out the bulk data collection of all of us.
Mm-hmm.
The government lied about it, concealed it. You know, we had that James Clapper testifying. It was Clapper, right?
Yes.
Before Congress, and said, no, we don't do that, or
That's
something
right.
like that. When
yep.
he was asked a question.
He lied directly to
Wyden.
Senator Wyden.
Yeah. This began in 2007. The only reason we know about this collaboration between internet companies and the NSA or the FBI, the only reason we know it is because of Edward Snowden. We wouldn't know it otherwise. I mean, Edward Snowden, who now has to live the rest of his life in exile, or if he came back to the United States, spend the rest of his life in prison, he told the truth to the American people. And there's all these stories now, and it's such a big issue now, and the government is trying to overcome it now using all sorts of new rationales. But the only reason we know it is because of the whistleblower.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I mean, we owe a great deal to Edward Snowden for explaining this to us. And there's that famous slide from the PRISM presentation that shows the long list of companies that provide access in one way or another to the intelligence agencies about our accounts. And Facebook is right up on there, along with AT&T, along with Apple and Google and MySpace, which was a thing back then, and all these other social networks and online sites. And it's not just about Facebook or another company handing them data that they request. It's about actually providing just a direct feed into the data that Facebook and other companies are collecting on us. We've talked in the past about how the NSA has rooms in a number of AT&T facilities around the country that The Intercept released information about, that we know AT&T just has these rooms where they literally tap into the fiber lines and make a copy so that they can scan this information. And a lot, obviously all of this is information about American citizens, people residing in the United States, which, you know, Clapper said they weren't doing, and then we know now that they are.
Chris, we're trying, in, I guess, in almost every interview today to mention that that John Bolton said that the Russians, the Chinese, the North Koreans, and the Iranians are all trying to interfere in the 2018 election, which is, anyway, we're just saying that, like, every other country in the world that's targeted by the United States for overthrow is, in fact, trying to influence the outcome of the 2018 election. But let's talk about the security of the 2018 election. How vulnerable are voting machines? Because that's another story that you shared with us.
Voting machines are extremely, extremely vulnerable. There was a great story from WNYC's The Takeaway about this. So not this past weekend, but the one before, there was a security conference, a major conference in Las Vegas called DEF CON. One of the things they had there was a booth, actually a room with a number of election machines, you know, voting machines, the ones that you and I would use when we go to vote. And they said, okay, well, let's go and let people hack these. How long is it going to take? What can you get access to? A woman named Rachel Toback, a security researcher and CEO of a cybersecurity company, took 3 minutes to get into the administrative panel of one of these machines. It wasn't locked. All she needed was a ballpoint pen and to prop open the sides of the machines and to, you know, take one part out and then turn it on. And she was able to get into an administrative panel for this voting machine. So this breach of security is terrifying. We don't know what it means, you know, what somebody who goes in there could do. Now, that's one machine, but often if you're going into a voting booth, no one is watching you vote. You know, we have this expectation of privacy when we vote, but that means that somebody could actually go in directly and tamper with the machine. But these are also tend to be internet connected in some ways. They're networked to give reports about how many votes, how many people have voted. And so they're networked, and anything connected to a network could, in theory, be attacked. And so they also showed at DEF CON many remote attacks over the network without requiring you to, you know, be in front of the machine and, you know, pull a piece out of the side and disassemble it. So it's a very scary time. And we need to talk about these machines are not, you know, government created. These are private companies creating these machines that have there's no trust with these companies.
Chris, let me ask you, we have 2 minutes left, and I know we want to get to a technology tip for the week. But real quick, video game developers are making it harder to stop playing. What's that in 1 minute?
Oh, in 1 minute, this is just, there's something called gamification where, you know, if you increasingly give people rewards for doing something in a video game, they're going to get more addicted to it because they're going to want to come back and get that reward. It's, you know, it's a primal thing sort of in our brains. And video game developers, especially the pay-to-play ones, you know, you download it, it's free, but then you got to buy some coins, you got to buy this power-up that's going to get you past the next level. They are making literally, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars as an industry on these little mobile games. You know, you download it for free, but then you end up spending $100 or, you know, people spend thousands of dollars because of this addictive property of these games. And it's completely exploitative of our attention and our money.
Chris, what's our technology tip for the week?
I had a lot of people ask me about this, and I appreciate people reaching out to ask. It's about password managers. So we've talked in the past about how to choose a good password, and those need to be complex. So the best way to remember the password is to not know it at all. Put it into something called a password manager, which you use one password to unlock, a very long password that only you know, and it stores all of those complex passwords for you. So I would recommend that people use something called LastPass, and you can get it on your phone, on your computer, all of your devices, and you lock it with a special code, and you store all of your passwords in it, and it can open up websites and apps for you and put that password in. So your passwords can be extremely long and secure, and there's and they're locked up in this software for you.
I think I need that, John, because after Chris gave the technology tip a few weeks ago, I changed all my passwords. I made them long, complex with words, and I couldn't get into any of my accounts.
Yeah, you see, I actually use that password. What did you call it just now?
LastPass.
Yeah. And it's terrific. In fact, I forgot that I had it. My son said, hey, Dad, don't you already have it? And I said, oh, yeah, that's right. And I was able to recall my passwords.
We're going to leave it right there. That was Chris Garofalo. We talk to Chris every Monday in a segment called Technology Rules with Chris Garofalo, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedom, civil rights, and civil liberties. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.